Welcome to Addiction to Recovery. Our purpose and passion is to bring you not only the science of addiction,
but also the patient perspective and how the two relate. Welcome back, everybody. Another episode of Addiction to Recovery. I'm kind of lost because I haven't done the intro in a while. So. I'm Josh Solem. I'm a certified peer recovery specialist, and I'm joined by Dr. Heather Bell, who's a family doctor and also an addiction doctor. We are going to get back to a guest that we've had before.
Executive director of the Nevada Council on Problem Gambling. He was on a bit ago. Time escapes, you know, now that... Life just has gone fast, especially, I don't know, Ted, you don't, weather in Nevada is very different, but Minnesota, I think we've had all of 2 inches of snow all winter, which is super weird. It's been 60 the last couple, you know, days and weeks. So anyway, welcome back. I'm really excited. I actually just found some questions I left off with last time too. So yeah, we're excited.
All right. I'm excited to be back. And surprisingly, we had a couple neighborhoods that got a little bit of snow yesterday and part of the day here in Vegas. So we're experiencing a pretty big cold front mostly rain. But I heard reports of a little snow on the margins of the valley and certainly in the mountains.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So you got the Minnesota weather and we're hanging out with everybody else's weather all of a sudden. So...
So we were talking before, and there's so many questions that I have, but why don't we just acclimate people to what you do, what your title is, and you know, we won't go back all the way into your past, but let's just talk about what you're currently doing.
Sure. So I'm the executive director of the Nevada Council on Problem Gambling for about 5 months now. I just retired from a 32-year research position with our university system here in Nevada. The Nevada Council is an affiliate of the National Council on Problem Gambling. We're one of 35 state affiliates across the country. As such, we take no position for or against gambling. We simply recognize that for a small percentage of people, it does become a true addiction, and we want to be a resource for those individuals or their family members who are struggling. And most of the affiliates across the country have similar missions. Some of them are directly involved in treatment, and some of them are not. We are not here in Nevada, although we are a referral resource to the treatment resources we have. And I know a lot of your listeners there are probably in Minnesota, and in Minnesota, that's the Minnesota Alliance on Problem Gambling at mnapg.org if folks want to find a lot more information locally on what your resources are.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll put that in some of the notes too, the show notes. So yeah, so I kind of want to go back a little bit, you know, and talk about, we kind of touched on some of the risk factors, you know, especially in your story and talking about, you know, some of the, you know, it's, we just had someone on the last episode talking about, you know, adverse childhood experiences and traumas and, you know, and being the only behavioral addiction, obviously there's going to be parallels to other use disorders and such, you know, is there specific things though to gambling, like risk factors specifically to that, or, you know, what kind of are things that people should maybe look for or think about?
Sure. So interestingly, most of the risk factors are the same they are as they are for substance use disorders. So things like boredom, loneliness, isolation, depression, any type of loss or grief, any other mental health disorder is actually a risk factor for a gambling disorder. There are some medications called dopamine agonists that are used to treat things, for example, like Parkinson's or restless leg syndrome, that can cause the onset, sudden onset of compulsive behaviors, including gambling. Any family history of addictive disorders, whether it's gambling or substances, is a risk factor for all of the other addictive disorders. The age of exposure and frequency of exposure. So the younger that you're exposed and participate in gambling as a child, the greater the risk of developing a gambling disorder later on in life. It may not happen as a child or an adolescent, but it's setting up some of those neural pathways early on to be more more susceptible later on to a gambling disorder. Also, early childhood trauma, so a high score on what we call the adverse childhood experiences test. So the more trauma you experience or witness as a child. There are some gambling, kind of gambling specific ones that don't occur with the substances. One can be, a very large win or a series of wins over a short amount of time can sometimes cause people to start thinking about gambling as a way to make money as opposed to just having it as an entertainment. And the other thing is just, general financial stress. If you've got some of these other risk factors at play, sometimes people can rationalize that gambling is a way out of that stressful financial situation. Sure. In their lives. And usually, of course, the opposite is true. So that's just a few examples.
So it's interesting. I just want to touch really quickly on the like you said, a big win right away can be a risk factor. And that the first thing that came to my mind when you said that was a person who uses meth because of the dopamine surge is so much greater than other substances. So the likelihood of, becoming addicted to it is higher from like an earlier exposure. Have they studied any of that, like in terms of like dopamine surges, or is it just kind of one of those understood things just with?
Yes, the same neurotransmitters that are experiencing dysfunction with substance use disorders are at play with gambling disorders. So dopamine is a big one that's implicated, but also things like serotonin and norepinephrine and oxytocin, all these things our brain produces naturally, go a little haywire. And so that's a lot of the reason why I think you see so much co-occurrence between substances and gambling, or people switching from one to the other. And anecdotally, at least, I don't know that there's any research evidence for this, but anecdotally, I seem to have met many more people who often got clean and sober in a substance and then transitioned to a gambling disorder at some point in their lives. Again, I don't have any empirical evidence for that, but that I've heard a lot of stories along those lines.
Now, when you said something about a big win, and Heather kind of touched on the substance use that goes along with it, I can attest to, I had a big win early on in my meth addiction. It was a big win. I don't want to throw the money number out there, but it was a big win. And I basically just gave up my job and just stayed, and I was, And it wasn't as much for like funding my addiction, but it was just so I could escape even more because I was in such a bad place. The one thing I did want to touch on was one of the other things that I experienced was I think that there can be a correlation between a substance use person and going to the casino, trying to hit the big one so they can feed their addiction. There's this idea that if I can go and turn this $25 into $500, I can go buy a large amount of drugs and then be set. And I think that I don't know. I don't know if there's any way to like break that down, but I do feel like that's a big problem, with people.
Yes, I hear that story all the time, believe it or not. We're very active here in Nevada in engaging with our treatment facilities who are treating for substance use disorders. So we go in on, whatever their IOP or group cycle is and come in as peers in recovery ourselves simply to educate their clients about gambling as a potential addiction, regardless of whether or not they've experienced it. And of course, the end point of all those presentations is just opening it up for people to share if they have stories about gambling. And almost every session, you'll have at least two or three people in those groups share about how gambling has impacted them. But it's very common to say, hear people say, well, the only time that I actually gambled was when I was smoking meth, and then I, gambled for 48 hours straight, or I only went to the bar I only gambled to get the free drinks at the bar. But I've heard people say, I was dealing and I'd go to the casino and try to double my money and I'd lose it all. I'd get in trouble with my supplier. There was one very creative person that I heard once. It was like he would use casinos to mark people who had just hit big jackpots. And he said he could always just about guarantee that some percentage of them would be willing to buy from him after having those big wins. Sure. So that ties back into exactly what you were saying.
Yeah.
It would be interesting then to be able to, I don't know how you study this, but that perpetuation of severity of both the gambling and the substance use disorder, you know, kind of like you said, Josh, when you said, you know, you could go, let me get this much money and I can buy this much meth, because you hear that from people like, oh, if I don't have to go meet with my dealer every day to pick up, I can ration this. When in reality, right, nobody can ration substances, right, in theory. I mean, in reality theory, I don't have the data on that, but the severity and the, you know, that telescoping, if you will, of the use and the gambling together just to make that worse.
Absolutely. And the national SAMHSA figure actually is that 10 to 15% of people who have a substance use disorder will also suffer from a gambling disorder. But if we do not screen for it, we do not catch it, because it's the one thing that people are either likely to not be honest about, or it's very common for people not to even recognize gambling as part of their addictive disorder until much further into treatment for their substance use disorder. And they've kind of begin to be a little more honest with themselves and looking at their behavior. So we always recommend that anybody treating for substances ask a couple questions about gambling, not only at intake, but about midway through the therapeutic process, and then again before discharge, because people's journey is going to be different in all those points, and they may be able to see something new at the end of that.
Well, and I like that you said that, because now working in an inpatient facility, you know, you're doing your intake and there's the questions you ask, and it's very substance, like all these substances, and I have to intentionally remember to ask. And, you know, I think the only reason I even remember to ask is because now I've known you for some time now, and it's just more in my brain. But it's interesting because, I mean, I tie that then asking about eating disorders and shopping things, which I don't know what my partners do, but, you know, having had an or have an eating disorder, like, I think to ask it. And it's interesting when you ask the gambling or you ask the eating disorders or you ask the shopping, how people kind of look at you like they weren't expecting it. And then they're like, oh, well, yeah. And, you know, because I just don't think it's kind of understood, and they're not expecting to talk about it. And I think,
yes,
I don't know what happens when they're already in treatment, but I know that I've tried to send people to treatment for gambling, and they need a special, at least in Minnesota, the treatment facility needs a special extra state, you know, numbered policy thingy, I don't know, law, rule, that even allows them to treat for gambling. So it's harder to even get that treatment.
Yes. I know the Minnesota Alliance on Problem Gambling does help facilitate, I think, connecting therapists who want to get that additional certification to that training. I don't know if they cover all the costs, but they're certainly the ones to reach out to find out about that process. But, you know, something you mentioned is very important about those screening questions and people kind of being taken aback a little bit when you ask them. And my dream, of course, is to get one or two gambling questions into the primary care physician's lexicon, so that when you go just to your annual checkup, right, you're asked about, you know, do you drink alcohol? How often? Yeah. Are you on any medications or any other type of drugs?
Do you feel safe?
Do you smoke? Yeah. Do you feel safe in the home? Yeah. Right. Adding one or two questions about gambling, even if that person is kind of taken aback or unwilling to answer that question honestly, if their doctor is asking them that question, all of a sudden there is an aha moment. It's like, wow, this thing that I'm experiencing must be real because my doctor is asking me about it, or that my brother or sister or significant other is experiencing. And that may encourage more help seeking than might have occurred otherwise.
Right. Now that you mentioned treatment, I do want to ask, A, have you been to treatment for gambling? And B, what does treatment for gambling look like? And the reason I ask is that Heather and I have talked about treatment for a lot, because we both have different views on when it's appropriate, what isn't. You know, I know that one of the first things I experienced was fear, because I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know what treatment looked like, and it was just really scary. So I think one of the things for our listeners, if anybody's out there that has thought about going to treatment for gambling, maybe if you could just give us a little bit of an insight what it looks like.
Absolutely. And for those of your listeners who may not have heard the episode where I shared my story, I am in long-term recovery myself from a gambling disorder about 16 and a half years. And it is a very scary thing to think you have this thing you can't control, whether it's a substance or a behavior. And so it was a long process for me to develop my addiction, and it was a long process for me to find my way to help. And that's why it's so important that I think that we have all these different modalities to help meet people where they are at any given moment. And in my own case, there was a 2-year period at the end of my gambling where I went through this process of recognizing that I had a problem, but believing and hoping for a long time that I could control it on my own. So, you know, I tried all sorts of things like, you know, leaving my ATM card in my car when I went into the casino, right? I'm only going to take $100 in and spend it. Like, I couldn't walk back out to my car and bring it back in, right? Or leaving it at home. And eventually when I did, you know, I had promised my wife for the better part of a year that I had stopped gambling. And the first couple times I did come clean to her on my own. And I said, I'm so sorry. I've been gambling again. There's this hidden debt. And I remembered, well, don't you think you should get some help? And that's when I went to my first 12-step meeting at that point in time. And she went to hers. Family side of things. And I can remember that first meeting very strongly. I remember hearing a few other people share, and then I was invited to share, and my little girl was just about to be born, and I said I don't want her to come into this world with me behaving in this way. I remember even crying a little bit. It was a little cathartic. And then I heard a lot of other people share. And I heard people share about losing their families. And I heard people share about spending time in prison for embezzlement because of their gambling. There were multiple people who shared about trying to end their own lives over their gambling. And by the time I left my very first meeting, I thought, well, I'm glad I came, but I'm certainly not like the other people in this room. I would never do any of those other things. I've heard how bad it can get, and that's going to be enough to keep me from doing that again. So I was abstinent for several months, and then I went out and tested the waters for myself. And after a very brief period of control, it was like I had never stopped. The lying behavior, the hiding behavior returned. The limits were out of control for me. So I repeated this process for about another year, came clean on my own again. This time I did go to a professional therapist, but you know, I like to personify my illness and talk about, I mean, it is me in many ways, and it's pretty sneaky. And so I used my employee EAP program, and I requested a marriage and family therapist who had no background in addiction whatsoever, right? And I went to see her on my own because, you know, goodness forbid that I would actually go with my wife. I certainly had marital problems, but that was not the root cause by any means. I had my few sessions. I repeated this same cycle again. The only thing that was different after the third year is that time my then wife found out on her own that I'd been gambling again and confronted me about it. The debt was many, many times what it had been in the previous years. And those were kind of the only differences. And in that moment when I felt that I was about to lose my family, and my little girl was 2 years old by this point, that woke me up in a way that all of this other stuff had not to that point. And I fully expected her to take our daughter and leave, but she said, don't you think you should get some serious help this time? And that is when I engaged with a program here. It's the Robert Hunter International Problem Gambling Center here in Las Vegas, which is a 6-week intensive outpatient program. They also required at that time minimum attendance at 3 recovery meetings a week, in addition to the program I was going through. And initially I resisted that because I thought, well, I've tried that before. I'm pretty sure that's not going to work for me. But it was in pretty short order, especially I think since some of my stories had started to match up a little more closely with what I'd heard in that first one, that I came to understand the power of those meetings. And I know lots of people for whom that's all they needed. They found a 12-step program. They engaged with it. They never went to any professional treatment. They remain engaged today. And then I know lots of people like me who maybe tried it and thought it wasn't for them, engaged in some professional therapy, may or may not have re-engaged with a 12-step, but maybe some other recovery group. And I think the evidence is pretty clear that the two in tandem are what work best to kind of keep people in however they personally define what their recovery is. But there also is such a thing as both natural recovery in the gambling world, and there is such a thing as harm reduction, as there is in the substance realm of people that I know. In fact, we're going to feature one at our Problem Gambling Awareness Month tomorrow. William Hung, who is of American Idol fame, season 3, who had his many minutes of fame, has become very public about his own struggles with gambling recently in the media. And he lives here in Las Vegas, and I invited him to come tell his story. And he is somebody who has identified different forms of gambling that he has able to keep under control, at least for now, you know, and I have no judgment about that. It's like, okay, if you can do that and do it safely and you're not causing harm for yourself or others in your life, let's continue to that explore that. But he is also someone who has had a professional help in that realm. So he's kind of has a lot of those tools in the background as well. So that's a very long answer to your question. I know, but it really is kind of about meeting people where they are. Sure. And offering those tools that they're willing to engage in this moment. Right.
So you mentioned the meetings, and you know, I know there are Gamblers Anonymous meetings, and I don't know your experience or your thoughts on, you know, going to a general AA meeting or an NA meeting or, you know, one of those meetings, because, you know, there are meetings where they, at an AA meeting where they're like, nope, we are talking about alcohol, everybody else peace out. Yes. Do you have experience with going to other types of meetings, and or what have you heard, or are they pretty welcoming? And obviously I'm assuming it varies across the country and in things, but
yes,
there's still 12-step base.
That's a great question. And it's been a mixed bag for me. Sometimes, actually all the time, when I go out of town for a conference or just for a vacation, I always check to see if there might be some meetings available for me locally. And if there are not in my particular addictive disorder, I will often just go to a substance meeting. And like you say, some of them are pretty strict about only sharing about alcohol, for example. And if you get off the path there, they kind of pull you back in. And some are not. You know, some have treated me just as a guest where I couldn't share, and some have allowed me to share about gambling. That is not really the case at all in the gambling specific meetings, just because so many of us, and in fact about 50% of those of us who are diagnosed with a gambling disorder, will also suffer from a co-occurring substance use disorder. So while it's 10 to 15% on the other side of that equation, for those of us with a gambling disorder, a lot of us have or are struggling with substances as well. And cigarette smoking is way high up there too as a comorbidity.
I'm sorry.
I didn't finish that thought. So,
okay.
So you will hear people share in those meetings about substances all the time, and nobody stops them generally in the gambling specific meetings, just because it is so common among that membership.
Do you mentioned harm reduction, and so I want to touch on that, because I actually had a question from this from our last time we were talking, because we mentioned sports gambling and how that's been legalized. You know, and in my mind, that's kind of likened to, like, Minnesota, we just legalized cannabis. It's like that harm reduction concept when it comes to substances. do you kind of see that as the same, or what are your thoughts on certain legalization of certain gambling things, and or I don't know, what kind of, what's the harm reduction thing? Because it's almost like alcohol, that there it's legal.
Yes.
But, you know, how does that look harm reduction wise?
It's a great question, because I kind of came into my recovery right as that conversation was starting to happen around gambling. It had already been happening for substances for some time, but it was starting to happen around gambling. And I remember, since I had, of course, attended a program that was completely abstinence-based and was involved with 12-step that was abstinence-based, I was, even as a researcher, I was taken aback. It's like, this can't really work, right? Because it didn't work for me. I certainly tried to, you know, personally reduce my harm for years, and it never worked. And so, but I, you know, I slowly came around to the idea that this can work also for gambling, and especially from the standpoint of helping people who are clearly struggling find their way into some type of therapy. Because with gambling, as I suspect with substances, there are so many people who just cannot imagine never gambling again, and they completely resist the idea that they're going to go to any type of program where that is the goal. But if you can dangle that carrot out there and say, hey, we do harm reduction here as well, if that is your goal, we will work with you to try and develop strategies and or a program where you can continue to engage in reduce your gambling, or find a different type of gambling you still enjoy but you're able to control. And it may be during that therapeutic process that that person discovers, oh, I'm not actually able to do any of this. But then they've started to get some of those tools, and maybe they will decide, okay, let's go for abstinence. What does that look for me? What are those tools? But just simply as a way to attract more people who are suffering into some type of program to help them manage what they are experiencing, I think is the big picture in that.
I just wanted to go back to the meetings thing one more time. About I go to AA meetings regularly, and there's an app that I found a while back, but it will tell you where and when meetings are based on your location, and it's really, really handy, and it's been a lifesaver for me, really, because I can go wherever and find a meeting and what time, and then I can go. Is there any, because I've been looking and I can't find one for GA or even NA to have one. Where do you look? Like you said, you go to a conference somewhere. Where can you find the information as to where and when a meeting is in the area you're going to?
Yes, so I an app is a great idea. I'm not aware of one either for gambling, but you can certainly go to gamblersanonymous.org, and you can find not only meetings in the U.S. but across the world, where they're located, when they meet, or at least a number in that jurisdiction to call. But most of those are publicly listed, along with the days and the locations of where those are occurring. And if the pandemic brought us anything good at all, it's that both the treatment and recovery communities have gone almost fully online, so that even though we have over 100 meetings a week here in the Las Vegas Valley, I know that if I wake up at 2 or 3 a.m. and have an urge, I can certainly within 5 minutes be gambling. But now I know if I've got a phone or I've got access to a computer, I can go to gamblersinrecovery.com, and that is a link both for people who are suffering from a gambling disorder as well as those who are affected others. And you can find meetings 24/7 that are going on online. You can choose to show your face or not. You can choose to type your real name in or not. It's almost an additional layer of anonymity. And, you know, I can get that medicine that I need in the middle of the night to calm that urge and hear others share. And there's one other site, which is recoveryroadonline.org. And that is also another resource for people with a gambling disorder that's not quite structured the same as your Gamblers Anonymous meetings, which are primarily the format that's used for gamblersandrecovery.com, but very, very similar. So those are two great online resources that anybody can access 24/7.
Well, I think that's really important, you know, to get that information out there, because, you know, it's just, it's not, people don't know that there's all this stuff available, and it's out there to help, you know, these resources. And I'm glad that we could have you on here so that we can at least, I don't even know this stuff, you know, like it's, I should know this stuff, especially being in the field I'm in. I should know where to go online to help people that are gambling, because it is so common to see people that are in meth recovery that still have a gambling urge, and it will trigger the meth use like real fast. So I think it's important. So I appreciate you sharing that.
I even hear stories of people who are, you know, jointly in, say, AA and GA, that say sometimes that their AA meeting, their after meeting, is at the casino, and people will get together, you know, and so not advisable for certain, but people probably aren't aware that they are putting themselves at tremendous risk
by
engaging in that behavior. One other resource I want to mention, just in case I forget to at some point, is there is a national helpline that is 24/7, completely confidential, completely free, and that is 1-800-GAMBLER. So regardless of, this is works in all 50 states and U.S. territories, it will connect you to the call center associated with the area code that you are calling from initially, but they can do a warm transfer to one of the other call centers if you're calling from out of state, and or if your area code, it does not match up to where you are. And that's super important, because it's a very memorable number that really has only been in play nationally for about a year and a half. Prior to that, it was a number nobody could remember, and now we have something that if you see it or hear it once, you can always remember. And a lot of the states, unfortunately, had written specific numbers, helpline numbers, into their legislation, so they have to continue to advertise those. Or they have a branded number, right? They want people to know. And in Minnesota's case, that's 1-800-333-HOPE. That will connect you to help. But the nice thing is all of the state councils have the ability to say where they want that 1-800-GAMBLER number to be transferred. And if you call 1-800-GAMBLER from a Minnesota area code, you will connect to that same resource as if you'd called 1-800-333-HOPE. So very important to know that.
Josh?
Well, I really have some thoughts about, like, my experiences in casinos, and I don't know what it's like in Las Vegas. I mean, I've been there, but I definitely wasn't in an addiction situation. I mean, I drank quite a bit when I was there. But in Minnesota, there's these signs, and they say, you know, they're very strict on meth or drug use. I don't think they necessarily point out meth, but, you know, I don't see that they really do. Do you know what the policy is in Las Vegas with trying to, you know, stop the traffic of people that are under the influence of drugs in their casinos? Because the reason I ask is that I honestly don't believe they do, because I was in there all the time, and I was not hiding my highness, I should say. And, you know, the only time I really got in trouble there when I was really doing things that were detrimental to the casino. And do you know, I mean, is it something that they really have a high priority on, is keeping drugs out of the casino?
So this is something that, again, I feel is a very mixed bag, depending on the organization that you happen to be gambling in and the property. Some of the larger properties have, all of them certainly have this written into their policy, right? And all of them have duty of care with regards to things like serving alcohol and cutting people off if they're intoxicated. But again, in practice, you know, what does that look like? And I think that is highly variable from property to property. And here in Las Vegas, for example, the a lot of the locations that primarily serve locals are these small bars. It's basically all it is. It's a bar with a bunch of slots and or video poker machines, and that is essentially it. And that's all the people in those places are doing. I know in many cases, because I'm a big karaoke fiend, and so I hit lots of karaoke bars all the time. But it's only since I've had this new hat on with the Nevada Council that I've begun to check, do they have written materials that they are required by state regulation to have on problem gambling near their ATMs or in the larger organizations near the casino cages? And I would say about half the time, these places are out of compliance with some pretty basic regulations. So I suspect, as you said, you know, depending on the location and situation, there's going to be some kind of looking the other way, right?
It's a business too.
It is a business. Yes.
So, but. Oh, sorry. Yep. Yeah. But.
Well, yeah.
And let's face it. I ran a lot of money. And they not only didn't, they had to know that I was using meth because I was in that high stakes for hours. I mean, almost 24 hours at a time. I'd only leave to go to the bathroom or go get high again. They not only let me stay there, but they put me up in a hotel room, you know.
Oh, yes.
They gave me all kinds of free food and all that stuff because they wanted the money back, and they got it back. But, you know, it's like, I feel like there's got to be more cooperation on how to recognize, because that is a sick place to be in your head when you're using both meth and you're gambling. It's like the devil's playground. It's crazy. I can't even explain. Yes. It
there's a lot of this is a big discussion right now, you know, this the area of responsible gambling, RG, often you hear that as the acronym within the industry. I think there is more and more a recognition, and I think a near universal recognition that industry does have some duty of care, even if it's not in the legal sense in the state where they are. And in fact, there's emerging research evidence that shows that if you have these strong tools and programs in place, you can actually build long-term player loyalty and value, because you are identifying issues early on and possibly connecting people to resources for help before they present, you know, clinically for a disorder that now may disrupt so many areas of their life that they, you know, burn themselves out of this world pretty quickly. And so, you know, somebody like me who gave the industry tremendous amounts of money in the final 2 years I was gambling is not, and nor will I ever be, a walking advertisement for industry or the place that I loved to gamble. You know, had I known from an educational standpoint and or a brief intervention standpoint very early on what was happening to me, it's possible I might still be a customer having fun throughout my life. And of course, it's in the industry's best interest as well. There needs to be a paradigm shift in the way that they think about this issue, because in order to address it fully and in a way that is beneficial to all, they are absolutely going to take a hit for a while on their bottom line. There's no doubt that we disproportionately fund profits in the industry, and that's going to have to happen up front. But I think the long-term benefits for everybody, including society and the safety net system, is greatly exceeds the potential downside from a hit to your pocketbook.
Okay, so a couple different things that kind of piggyback on that. So there's obviously different regulations and different laws in different states, and I don't know how familiar you are with, you know, what that data trends, what that looks like, and if you're not specifically, kind of what your at least anecdotal thoughts would be, you know, because Minnesota, all of our gambling outside of, you know, some of the online stuff you can do and or, you know, scratchies and pull tabs is at on the reservations. You know, it's not just in our grocery stores and gas stations, whereas I lived in South Dakota for a time. And I mean, they had just pop up, you know, kind of like that pop up cannabis things that are going to be starting. But they have like pop up just small gambling buildings. I don't even know. Is there a difference in different states based on the availability and that, you know, because again, that kind of looks at that harm reduction, like we're just going to normalize it. But does states like South Dakota have more, you know, I guess, quote unquote, problem or gambling addiction than places where it's a little bit more regulated to specific locations?
Oh, it's a great question. And it is an absolute patchwork quilt from state to state on regulations and funding for this issue. And Nevada, who should be a leader, quite from my point of view on this issue, because we are a leader in other parts of the integrated resort casino world, actually bounces around between 11th and 13th in the country in our funding for this issue per capita. I would say only the top three states even fund this issue adequately. The regulations around what licensees have to do or have to display on property or whether they're taxed at all, what we call self-exclusion also can be a very, very important tool, at least for people who are interested in reducing or eliminating gambling from their life. Almost every state in the country that has some type of legalized gambling, particularly casino style gambling, has regulations that require those properties to be able to provide some paperwork to individuals to say, I want to be excluded from gambling on your property. Usually that means they can't go on property at all, or they could be trespassed. And sometimes it's that legal thing hanging over people's head that it provides a little psychological boost not to go in there. Some states, if you exclude from one property, that goes into a database that's shared with every single property in that state, so you are automatically self-excluded everywhere. And these are often offered in 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and permanent increments, depending on how you sign up. But again, this varies from state to state. In Nevada, of all places, we do not have the opportunity for people to self-exclude either from individual or multiple properties in this state. What we have is what's called self-limiting. And every licensee has to provide patrons the ability to opt out of things like direct mail marketing, the ability to engage in rewards programs, the ability to cash checks on property, but it does not prohibit anybody from gambling. We have properties like Caesars. Caesars is probably one of the best in terms of how long they have addressed this issue at a much higher level than most states require them to do so. They actually do have self-exclusion. If you self-exclude from any Caesars property in the country, you are automatically self-excluded from all of their properties across the country. But we had a situation here in Nevada where somebody went in, they gambled anyway, they hit a major jackpot, which, Caesars policy is if you come in and that happens, we're not going to pay you. And all of that money is going to go into whatever the state's problem gambling fund is. They don't even keep that money. Wow. But this person sued them and won. And the Nevada Gaming Control Board required Caesars to pay that out because we do not have it as a state regulation, which I found absolutely astounding that individual properties cannot have this higher level policy and adhere to them in order to protect people. And so we have lots of work to do here still. But to your question, it is again just this patchwork quilt. There is no federal regulation at this point. In fact, there is not a dollar of federal funding towards the issue of problem gambling. We have hundreds of billions of dollars that goes to substances. We don't have a single dollar, and there are upcoming remedies to that, hopefully.
But there are. I was just going to ask: is that something that you or that you people are actively working on with the legislation?
Yes, particularly on the national level. The National Council on Problem Gambling has for a couple years now been building advocacy efforts around what's called the GRIT Act, which was introduced a couple months ago by Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut and Representative Salinas from Oregon. And it would basically take an existing pot of money, it's a federal excise tax on sports betting, which now, of course, is occurring almost across the entire country. And there's currently a 0.25% excise tax collected on every legal sports bet that is made in this country that has essentially gone into the federal general fund and not been used for anything related to gambling pretty much since it was formed. It would take half of that fund, and it would take, it's a little bit complicated, but take 75% of that half and return it directly to the states through the substance use block grant program. So wouldn't create a new tax, You wouldn't need a new bureaucracy to get it back to the states, but it would earmark those monies specifically towards problem gambling. And each state could decide where in that area they had the most need. The other 25% of that would be managed by a federal department specifically for the purpose of research grants. Right now, we only have a couple million dollars spent a year on research even, and that's funded primarily through the industry. This would immediately create a pot of money between $30 and $40 million, and most of the states would get anywhere from $1 to $4 million a year simply from what's returned to them specifically for use. So it seems like a no-brainer. The industry has come out. You know, the American Gaming Association has come out vociferously against it. They think it's bad tax policy in general that it even exists. But honestly, we're so far behind the curve that we need to do it.
And I'm not going to get in trouble with the government by saying what I really think of them. But this is an area where it's maddening. And when you hear stuff like that, and you're like, how straightforward is this? Why wouldn't we do this? And it's just,
especially because it's already being taxed. Right. Why would that not benefit? And it's such a small percentage. And yeah, we can go on.
And it actually is tied to the gambling itself. You know, you're taxing.
Exactly.
You're not taxing the people that don't gamble. You're taxing the ones that do. And it drives me nuts.
So one other thing, at least that I have a question for, and you half mentioned it, in terms of legalities and, you know, like and consequences, you know, and substance use, I mean, that's what our jails are filled with. And, you know, that tends to be society's way of treatment, if you will. And that's one of my like soapbox topics, so I won't go into that. But what does that look like when we talk about gambling addiction? Because it typically is a victimless crime in a way. Crime is the right word, but you know, an addiction in itself, a substance use disorder with substances, is initially at least a victimless situation directly. Yes. But what does it look like in the gambling world?
So in the gambling world, unfortunately, by the time somebody develops a clinical disorder, they are usually impacting not only themselves, but loved ones in their immediate sphere. We tend to impact 7 or 8 other people in our lives pretty significantly. And so while I was, I had all this hidden debt from my family, for example, that was, you know, approaching what for us was a large amount of money. At the same time, my family had no idea it was even happening at that point. So while I was impacting them tremendously, they did not know until everything hit the fan how deep that hole was. But I've known people who ran businesses, you know, to, you know, $10 million budget, legal business, where all of the employees lost their jobs essentially when it came out that these trust funds had been raided and, you know, a senior partner had been embezzling funds. So that's just a small example. In my personal case, and I can't remember if I shared this in my story, I was somebody who had a fairly high level government security clearance. And when you are desperate enough to hide something from people in your lives, you then become susceptible via coercion or blackmail from people with nefarious intentions. And, you know, I had the potential, fortunately unrealized potential, to jeopardize this country's national security in my gambling disorder. So when we talk about this as a public health issue, it is every bit as much a public health issue. Those people who present with the most severe cases of gambling disorder, about half of them have started to engage in some type of criminal activity in order to finance their gambling. Not to buy wonderful things in their life. It's not a greed-related issue. They're not buying nice cars and taking nice vacations. Usually they're often living fairly destitutely, even though they may be stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from their employer. So that's kind of what it looks like in the gambling world. It's why I suspect the suicide rates are so high with gambling disorder, because sometimes the family can go from not even knowing that there is a gambling problem present to finding out, you know, our entire life savings is gone, the kids' college education fund is gone, by the way, we're going to lose our house next week or be evicted from our apartment because I have not been paying that for 6 months. And it's very easy for somebody like me to rationalize, my family is better off in this world without me in it, because look what I've done to the people I care about most in this world. So Yeah, lots of parallels there.
It almost sounds, I don't say more severe. I mean, by the time that you get to those legal levels, I mean, these are big crimes. You know, these are prison sentences where, I'll say at least, but in substance use disorder world, we're talking a lot of like jail time, jail time, jail time until it's like repeated, repeated, repeated. Okay, now you're doing some prison time. And so I think that just to me, it says the screening for this is just that much more important. I'll say more important than anything else, but it just seems so, I mean, we're talking big crimes that I think go so unrecognized by so many people in society. Like we think about, you know, dealers selling to kids and, you know, our dealers possessing, we have too much, you know, substance on us and we should go to jail for that. Whereas those are little things caught up to us. This is just seems so astronomical. And, you know, I guess I didn't think about it in terms of like what you just said. By the time it gets noticed, it's
big.
It's very big.
Yes, that's another thing, of course, that distinguishes gambling disorder from substance use disorders is that it can be hidden for so long. If the person can find creative ways to juggle the finances, there's not necessarily any physical presentation of symptoms of any kind. Certainly in retrospect, people will often see the mood changes, the lying and unexplained absences. But in the moment, people's minds rarely go to gambling. And from a legal perspective, Nevada is currently this is one thing we do well, is the only state in the country that has a gambling specialty court that is very much like our drug and alcohol courts, our veterans, our mental health courts. So you have the potential, as long as there's not a crime of violence involved, if you've embezzled $10,000 or $10 million from your employer, it doesn't matter. And you can show that your crimes were committed in furtherance of a gambling disorder. You're willing to begin making restitution and willing to, you know, it's usually a 2 to 3 year program you are sentenced to, but you stay out of prison, you get to stay with your family, you start to make restitution to your victims now as opposed to maybe never if you head off to prison, and you certainly are not going to get the treatment that you need in prison because there are huge gaps. They're not even, it's rare to find a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in prisons. We have tried to get them in, and there is resistance. There's lots of gambling that goes on in prisons for cigarettes and other type of contraband, and so people are going to come out, they're going to reoffend. So it really is a win-win-win situation. There are multiple states, I believe, New Jersey and Ohio, that are looking to us as a model in that area. But it really, we didn't even get into the youth focus really in the sports betting. But so many young people, adolescents and emerging adults are starting to gamble on sports, especially because of the glut of advertising we're seeing on TV, both during and preceding the games. And kids know how to get around some of the age things on some of these apps, parents are usually pretty ill-equipped to have conversations with their kids about why gambling is an adult activity and should be delayed until you're of legal age to engage in it. So there really is this kind of emerging issue across college campuses, especially where. And I don't know if we got into this last time. Forgive me if I'm being redundant, but about 2/3 of students who live on campus are engaged in sports betting. Wow. And among that population, almost 70% are either not of legal age to be doing so, or they live in jurisdictions where it is not yet been legalized. So about 1/3 of them report using a student bookie, right? So this is a huge issue that needs to be addressed on multiple levels, but especially in the education realm.
Okay, so I'm super glad you jumped onto the youth for a minute, because I've had this question written and I didn't even know when would be an appropriate time to ask, and this is one of my weird things that my poor kids, but maybe not poor kids because I save them time. Things like meat raffles or raffle tickets for, you know, school or sports, raising money, but there's a prize involved. Like my girl's like, I don't sell their raffle tickets unless there's people I know, like, and I do it, and or I just buy the whole book that I'm required to buy because I'm just like, no, I'm not having my kids go door to door for this. Or like meat raffles, like our Catholic school does meat raffles to raise money for things. And to me, that's just asinine because I'm like, oh my gosh, we are, here we are, we're sending our kids into a bar to sell these meat raffle tickets to raise money. And in my head, I'm like, that's gambling. And
absolutely,
people think I'm crazy. And I'm like, no, I will not put my kids in that situation. And, you know, yes, there's app things. And I mean, my kids are so sick of me talking about addiction. I think they could all write the book by this point. But how can you comment on things like that, which seems so innocuous, this, the meat raffles and the raffle tickets for sport things? And I get it from a fundraising perspective, but where's that line? And what do you think parents should do or could do or would help minimize that exposure to kids? Because I think last time we did talk about kid exposure, you know, like with yourself.
Yes. So you're absolutely right. It does constitute gambling activity. Basically, a way to think of gambling is simply wagering something of value to try and win something of value where the outcome is uncertain. And that's whether it's based on chance and or skill. So that's a very general, broad definition, but it really does get to the heart of kind of what happens in the reward center of the brain. When you put something out there of value, you're risking that loss of that thing to try and win something you perceive of greater value. Raffles are certainly qualify for that, even though they're often for good causes, right? Raising money for a school trip, school uniform, for the church, bingo, right? In the church. Well, it's a, you know, I think they're appropriate activities as long as they are adult activities. We need to realize, and kudos to you as a parent for recognizing this, even though, as you've said, other parents think you're crazy. That just kind of shows the lack of general education around gambling, where, you know, if people think of substances and gambling, well, substances obviously are the thing of greater concern and focus. Schools often think gambling is not a problem in their high school. I promise you it's a problem in every single high school in this country. A significant percentage of kids are already gambling in high school, and they're setting themselves up for issues. So this is why we need to get this discussion into the elementary schools, mm-hmm. at the same time that we start talking about substances and addiction and cigarettes. We know that that education doesn't prevent everyone, right, from engaging in those things, but it does provide a baseline and a context for everyone as they are growing up to know these are risky substances. I've been told in a number of different ways they can become addictive. There are places to go to get help if they do, and people get treated successfully through a number of different modalities all the time. That just does not exist yet for gambling.
And I feel like we're going to, like 20 years from now, we're going to go, boy, we should have done something when this whole sports gambling thing started. Because if you watch a sports game, big nationally televised, I should say, let's just use hockey, for example. If it's on TNT and they'll, in between periods, they'll put live, up-to-date lines. Like the Washington Capitals playing the Dallas Stars, and the Washington Capitals are +300 on the money line, and and it's there. And so my point is that kids are learning what that means. I mean,
yes.
If you know, people, I mean, I know what that means because I had a gambling problem. So I know what, you know, -1.5 means, or basketball game, you know, in game stats or in game lines is, you know, Timberwolves are +10.5, you know. And I think most people would have no clue back 5 years ago. And now, I mean, our kids, 10-year-olds, know what that means.
I don't, but that's okay.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I would absolutely support a ban during and immediately prior to all games, because this is when families are sitting down to watch these and rooting on for their favorite teams. And again, there's no context for either the kids or the parents, at least today, what any of that could potentially mean for them. Sports betting is, there's more and more research being done around this, but it seems to be a specific type of gambling where people who engage in it report more problematic behaviors, more problematic impacts than any other type of gambling. People who engage in sports betting are more likely to engage in more other types of gambling. There also are a lot more cognitive distortions around people's thoughts of, this is a type of gambling that I can make money doing, and this is particularly true in that 18 to 24 year old, probably younger. It's just much more difficult to do the research on the young populations for a number of different reasons. But it's a significantly emerging issue. We see a younger demographic coming into our 12-step meetings for this. We see greater use across the country of the National Problem Gambling Helpline. I should say, I do want to offer the caveat, that's not necessarily all bad news, right? We want people to be reaching out for help. And one of the effects that the advertisements on TV have had, as it's been legalized, is you see that 1-800-GAMBLER number up on the screen, and maybe people who have long had an issue, whether they were betting with a bookie or an illegal offshore account, are now being exposed to pathways to seek help. Sure. So that's the positive side.
I feel like they should sandwich any of those lines with the 1-800 number, you know, before they give the line, here's the problem gambling number, give the line, and then here's the problem gambling number. You know what I mean? I find it, you know, real fascinating, because during my drug use, I didn't watch sports. I didn't watch TV much at all. And then to come back and start watching some sports now and seeing all that, man, that's crazy to me. I'm like, wow, it used to be like, Las Vegas didn't even have sports teams because there was so much of that fear of, point shaving and throwing a game and all that stuff. And now, I mean, we're talking about gambling in the arena, arena that the game is going on live. It's just crazy to me. So, I mean, and Ted, we're going to have to wrap up here, but there's so many questions I didn't get to, so I really hope that we can have you on again, because I mean, just in the sports gambling, we just started to touch on it, and Minnesota hasn't legalized it yet, but I'm guessing it's going to be coming very soon, and it's going to affect a lot of people, and I think that getting your information, to us, like data, what have you seen is the increase in people reporting problem gambling now that those online sites are being legal and the sports betting is legal. So, and I think that you're a wealth of information for us. So, the one thing I did want to ask before we go is when you talked about the criminal stuff, do you know if there's any data that says, because they usually have an idea of how many people that are incarcerated are in there on drug charges. Is there any, studies on how many, because obviously there isn't like gambling charges, but that are directly related, like the embezzlement. Is there anything out there that says that?
So those studies are just starting to be done. I would encourage you or anybody who is interested in this topic to Google the name Dr. Michelle Malkin, M-A-L-K-I-N, someone who is in recovery herself and spent some time in the carceral system and came out and got her PhD and is now at, I believe, Eastern Carolina, and tremendously supported for research in this area, and is coming out with all sorts of fantastic information related to criminality and problem gambling and gender-based studies. It's fantastic stuff. And so that is a great place to start to go down that rabbit hole.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wow. I think we took a lot of tangents, but with very good undertone. And this was so, so great. And again, we are just so grateful for your wealth of knowledge and experience and passion, clearly, in this topic. So,
well, I feel like we have like the main guy now, like,
well, we do.
We have this direct,
of Nevada, if there's going to be a state to go to.
Right. And you've got your ear to the game, and I don't like to say the game, but you know what I mean? Like you're involved, and we can get a lot of the up-to-date information. So I'd like to, have an open invite to see if we can get you on as kind of a regular guest, because it is important to me, because I had a problem with gambling and I never want to go back.
I'd love to do that. You do have, I will say, you have a great resource there in Minnesota, Susan Sheridan Tucker, who runs the Minnesota Alliance. She is also the current president of the National Council on Problem Gambling. Mm-hmm. And so there is somebody right in your backyard that you could have on, and she could tell you much more about local resources there than I ever could. And so she's a fantastic resource as well.
Awesome.
Good to know.
Heather, anything else?
I don't think so. Just okay. Thanks again. And
do you have anything we want to leave us with, Ted?
You know, I don't think so. I just really appreciate the time and attention to this issue. It's much appreciated.
Well, thank you so much. And we look forward to having you on again. And again, if anybody has any issues with gambling, you know, there's so many resources out there. I really encourage you to look into it. And if you have a family member, same thing, you know, look into getting help yourself, because this is just like a substance use. If you have a family member, you're dealing with some stuff and you need to get support. So I really highly encourage, we'll put that information on our
in the show notes. So feel free to check that out.
Yeah. So thank you again, Ted. And we look forward to having you back.
Great. Have a great week.
Working together, we can move addiction to recovery.
If you would be so kind, please go to wherever you listen to your podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating, possibly a comment, but for sure click to follow us so you never miss an episode. Most importantly, don't forget to share our episode with a friend.
And as always, if you would like to ask us a question, have a topic recommendation, or would even want to be a guest on our show, email us at addiction2recoverypodcast@gmail.com. That's addiction2recoverypodcast@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Twitter at A2RPodcast. Or on Facebook or Instagram at Addiction to Recovery Podcast.